Welcome to GI Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Richard Goldberg, and we began by talking about colorectal cancer. And to do this, Dr. Goldberg presented a very difficult and challenging case from his practice.
This is a case of a 55-year-old woman who I first met last spring. She had recently lost her husband. Soon after that, started feeling ill, developed jaundice, and presented to her local emergency room. She was found to have a liver literally full of metastatic colorectal cancer and a primary lesion in the cecum. She had biliary tract obstruction and ended up having a biliary stent placed. Her bilirubin was still elevated when I met her for the first time in clinic, and she was a performance score of 2+. So this was one of those cases where you sort of look at the person and you say, if this person is going to be rescued, it's going to happen fast. I'm going to have to treat him aggressively or send him to hospice. So tough case.
And, you know, kind of just a question now that's coming up with every patient with metastatic disease is a sort of mutation status, you know, KRAS and beyond. What information did you have on her?
Well, of course, we didn't have any information when I first met her, but we did test her as we do all patients at Ohio State University for microsatellite instability. Her tumor did not manifest microsatellite instability. We tested her for KRAS status, just KRAS exon 2 mutations, which is what we were doing at that time. And she was KRAS wild type. And she was somebody who I knew needed a really rapid response if we were going to help her. So I chose to treat her with an elevated bilirubin of about 4, even after stenting, with FOLFOX, because you can treat people even in liver failure and kidney failure with that combination. And then I also used bevacizumab.
Now, the other issue, too, is trying to think about relative efficacy of an EGFR antibody versus Bev to add to chemotherapy. And, of course, we're looking forward to the CALGB study. Hopefully, we'll have, you know, definitive data on that coming out soon, hopefully, I guess, at ASCO. But where are we today with that question? There have been some papers, you know, some studies that have come out in the last year or so sort of addressing this question. And now I guess you have to readjust your numbers in your head. Theoretically, I guess you should have a higher response rate to an EGFR antibody if you use these additional exclusion criteria. How do you look right now at a first-line situation? You have this patient here who needs a response because she's so sick. Other patients need a response because, you know, they need it in order to go for hepatic surgery. When you're in that kind of situation, what data do we have?
Well, we have data that I find not particularly satisfying at this point. So what I would say is we have data from the GONO study from Italy that looks at FOLFOXIRI plus bevacizumab showing a high response rate, but not a higher resection rate when adding bevacizumab to FOLFOXIRI. I think that in a fit patient, though, that's a very reasonable regimen to use. I also think you have to balance the toxicity of 3 chemo drugs and 1 biologic with how the patient's doing, their age, their comorbidities, and so that isn't the right choice for every patient.
For this patient, if she had had, you know, normal bilirubin, is that what you would have done?
You know, I'm on the fence about that. She was an older person. She had some other comorbidities.
You said she's 55, right?
Right, but she had some other comorbidities. She was sick from her cancer in addition to having an elevated bilirubin. And you know, you always walk that tightrope of, should I be really aggressive? Because if I'm not, she's going to fall off the edge of the cliff. Or am I going to treat her with too many drugs and bring her down before I have time to rescue her? And in this case, fortunately, the strategy that I chose, the FOLFOX plus bevacizumab, rapidly led to a response, and she was resurrected, literally.
And how did she tolerate the treatment?
You know, she tolerated the FOLFOX without any difficulty, no toxicity from the bevacizumab. Interestingly enough, after about 4 cycles, 4 months of treatment, she developed a liver abscess, probably because of the biliary stent. And, you know, FOLFOX does cause neutropenia in a large proportion of patients. Most of the time, they don't get into trouble with infectious complications, but having a biliary stent in there raises the likelihood that somebody's going to develop an infectious complication. We had to remove the stent, treat her with antibiotics, and then she got back on treatment again.
Was she hospitalized for this?
She was hospitalized for a couple of weeks. She was quite ill from the infection. We had to put a drain into her liver to relieve the abscess. And so it set her back quite a bit.
What had been going on with her clinically up until the point that she developed the abscess? Was she improving?
She was improving dramatically. She went from, you know, being basically confined to a chair and doing minimal activities of daily living to, she had a grandson born during this time. She was able to enjoy the new grandson and the family. She kept setting milestones of family events and was doing fine and achieving them up until recently.
Now, you mentioned that she was presenting with metastatic disease. Was she symptomatic from the primary, and what was your thought in terms of taking that out?
So she was not symptomatic from the primary other than mild anemia, which didn't really make her sick. And she was intensely symptomatic. She had a big liver. She was uncomfortable. She was losing weight. So this was one of those spots where I needed to jump in with systemic therapy and didn't think about delaying to have her go to the OR.
What happened to her primary with treatment?
So we could see dramatic shrinkage in her liver. We could see dramatic shrinkage in the primary, and we dodged the bullet of having to deal with the primary in this case.
Just a footnote in terms of where you are today, where we are today in terms of management of patients who present with metastatic disease where the primary is asymptomatic. At this point, is there a general consensus that these people, particularly like this one who has a lot of problems with the meds, should go for systemic therapy first?
Well, I believe that most of the time we can circumvent the need for any surgical delay in systemic therapy in these patients, unless they're obstructed or they're bleeding so badly that you feel like you're going to end up having to take them to the OR when they've got an ANC of 500. And so my default is to treat them with systemic therapy and not to jump in with a surgical approach initially.
I have heard people kind of express concerns, you know, from the other point of view of patients having the need for emergent surgery or emergent complications. If you have a patient where, you know, maybe the primary is asymptomatic, but the mets are asymptomatic and it can be pulled out with a, you know, laparoscopic procedure, do you sort of just take it out anyhow?
I don't think that's really necessary. You know, there's conflicting data on that, and there are a few small studies that are mainly retrospective that suggest, well, maybe there is some benefit to removing the primary in this setting. And then there are a number of other studies that suggest that you can do fine without doing that, including a phase 2 study from the NSABP. I tend to minimize a surgical approach in somebody with systemic disease as long as that seems safe.
So this lady, another issue, you had presented a case at our think tank last summer of a younger woman actually with metastatic disease who was BRAF positive. I'm curious whether this lady had BRAF testing and what that means nowadays.
So she didn't have BRAF testing. We don't routinely do it on all of our patients. We often do it in people who are looking at studies because we have some studies that focus on the BRAF mutated population. I believe that it's a predictive factor for bad outcomes, and if I had to guess, it wouldn't surprise me if this woman did have a BRAF mutation.
She sort of sounds like that kind of case.
Right, and it is a potentially druggable target, but we don't have any drugs on the market for it. So unless somebody's got an option for a clinical trial, it probably isn't something I would do in routine practice today.
And not to get too far off, but just sort of explore that one a little bit. I guess it seems like, disappointingly, and unlike lung cancer, which they're starting to report responses with the BRAF inhibitors that are out there, vemurafenib and dabrafenib, that wasn't seen with colon cancer. What is the thinking right now? Is there a thought about combining with a MEK inhibitor? What kind of strategy?
Well, absolutely. I think that combining targeted therapies is the future. And as we know, generally, we're not dealing with just one mutation in these diseases, but often multiple mutations. And therefore, multiple roadblocks are necessary to achieve the advantages that we see with targeted therapies.
So this lady has a good response to FOLFOX-BEV, and then unfortunately she gets this hepatic abscess. And then what happens?
Well, so then we put her back on 5-FU leucovorin and bevacizumab because I didn't want to make her really neutropenic for fear of reactivating the abscess. And she did well again for a while, until just recently she presented again with an elevated bilirubin and wildly progressive disease. So the advantage that I had suddenly disappeared.
And I'm curious what your thinking was in terms of the options at that point that you thought about and what you actually did.
Well, so I was getting her work up to go on a study that we have in second line of FOLFIRI plus regorafenib. When her liver functions went from okay to go on the study to a bilirubin of 4 again, we ultrasounded her, didn't have dilatation of the biliary tract. And so now I'm in the situation of, do I go back to oxaliplatin, which rescued her before, or what do I do about irinotecan, because her bilirubin's really high enough that this would interfere with the detoxification of irinotecan that requires liver enzymes. And unfortunately, what happened to her is she got infected again while she had the elevated bilirubin, ended up in the ICU for a couple of weeks with a gram-negative sepsis, and then never really recovered. So, you know, this is one of those cases that's on the other side of the spectrum we like to talk about. You know, we love to talk about our patients who are out 30 months, 35 months, 5 years with metastatic liver disease. This is a case where I met the lady in March, and by January, she had passed away of her disease.
Just as a side note, because I'm kind of curious about this, over the last couple of years, we've done a couple of symposiums where Dr. Sledge has brought up the issue of end-of-life care, questioning whether or not oncologists, you know, maybe are more aggressive than they should be in terms of chemotherapy, hospitalization, ICUs, et cetera. What actually happened with this lady? Did she die in the ICU?
No, she didn't. So, you know, I was heavily involved. I saw her in clinic. She came in with a blood pressure of 70 over 40, a fever, a white count. So I knew she had infection again. We resuscitated her in clinic with some IV fluids, gave her some IV antibiotics, admitted her to the hospital, and over 24 hours, her blood pressure continued to plummet, and she ended up going to the ICU. I talked with her and her family in the ICU about, did we want to intubate her? We made a decision that we would intubate her for a short time and support her for a short time, and either she would turn around or she didn't. She participated in that discussion. The last thing she said to me before she was intubated is, I'm really scared. 2 days later, her pressure was better. She was no longer oxygen dependent on the ventilator, and she came out of the ICU and went back to the floor. And then we had another discussion about how I couldn't really treat her at this time. And she had been really ill, and I didn't know whether there was going to be a chance to treat her with more chemotherapy. And so we made a decision she wouldn't go back to the ICU again. We talked about hospice. She had a son and a daughter who lived nearby and were prepared to take her home to the son's house and do home hospice at home. But she, again, took a turn for the worse and ended up dying in the hospital. So about 6 or 7 days after her initial admission.
And looking back on this very, very difficult situation at the end of her life, you know, is there anything sort of maybe that you think you would have done differently, particularly, for example, the intubation?
Well, things happened pretty quickly in this situation, and I talked carefully with the patient and the family. The patient was, you know, on a non-rebreather, sitting bolt upright, not really able to say, yeah, thanks, but I don't want your life-saving intervention. I do want your life-saving intervention because I'm not ready to go. And, you know, the good thing about this case, as opposed to several other cases that I've had recently, is ahead of time, we said either this is going to turn around quickly or it isn't, and we're going to do 48 hours worth of intensive care and then revisit it. You know, I took care of a young guy in his 40s, you know, a bicyclist who owned a bicycle store and, you know, an intense athlete, kind of a country class bicyclist. And he spent 4 weeks in the ICU on a ventilator with his family not able to make those decisions in the same way. And I have to say, I feel worse about that case than I do about this lady who, you know, we had a plan, we went for an intervention, the intervention didn't work, we didn't go there again.
Any sort of global impressions about oncology practice in the United States in general, globally? I know it's hard to make a generalization in terms of this issue of futile care at the end of life. Do you think that it's something that's common, rare, or in between?
Well, it was interesting. I volunteered to do a consult service in the hospital over the holidays, and I spent a lot of time in the ICU seeing patients who were on ventilators and, you know, critically ill with metastatic disease. Often it was disease that had just been diagnosed but was widespread. And of course, many of these were people with lung cancer just because of the nature of that beast being so much more aggressive than what we often see with colon cancer. And I did have a strong sense of futility in what we were doing in a lot of those cases. And some of the patients didn't have families, and so you didn't really have somebody who could act as a surrogate for them, and they couldn't answer for themselves. Some of them did have families. You know, maybe it was partly that it was the holidays and nobody wants their loved one to pass away on Christmas because then it forever ruins Christmas for you. But we did a lot of very expensive care that didn't lead to value for the patient or for the payer. And I do think that when you have these diseases that are inevitably going to be fatal, that if we're going to continue to pay for our new targeted agents, we're going to have to take money away from futile end-of-life care to direct it more toward early intervention and recognition that we can do more for people early in the stage of their disease.
So to be continued, but let's get back to some of the research developments in the field. And one issue there's been a lot of discussion about in the last couple of years and kind of would have applied to this patient except for all the problems she had with her liver, et cetera, and that's second-line therapy in the patient who gets chemotherapy bevacizumab first line, particularly in the KRAS wild type, or I'm not sure what the new name is going to be, but is there a new name for this sort of global predictive non-response?
Well, here's our big chance, Neil. We could coin a new name for it.
Yeah, but sort of KRAS, NRAS, I don't know. But in any event, or panel maybe, EGFR antibody panel, in any event. So that question of, you know, first of all, in the KRAS wild type patient, bevacizumab versus an EGFR antibody, and of course, the issue of continuation of Bev, the issue of aflibercept. Any data that's come out in the last 6 months or a year that you think is important to this question, and where do you stand right now about how you make this decision?
Well, the data is not very clear in this circumstance. So I think you have to look at the data and then you have to look at the patient and you have to make a decision. And there isn't any one decision that's right or wrong. So I would say that my attitude in most circumstances like this is to say that we've been successful in transforming colon cancer that's metastatic into more of a chronic disease than it was when you and I first started back in the Crosby, Stills, and Nash days years ago. And as a consequence, I want as many options as I can for the patients, and I want to use them in series. And so what I often do is I tend to use FOLFOX Bev as my first line. I have to admit that I now tend to use FOLFIRI Bev as my second line, even in the KRAS wild type patients. And then I fall back to an irinotecan plus an EGFR inhibitor for third line. And I think that the mechanism of action of the EGFR inhibitors is so much different than the other drugs that we use earlier on that often you see very satisfying and long responses in a subset of patients. And the smarter we get about limiting that subset of patients that we treat, the better, because we can direct the therapy to those who are most likely to benefit and not treat patients who won't likely benefit. And then, of course, there's regorafenib, which we're now using in last-line therapy, although there's some studies looking at it combined with chemotherapy in earlier lines. My own experience with regorafenib has been harder to give than I thought it would be. And I'm often having to reduce the dose, particularly in the population I see of older patients. The next question is, well, what do you do with aflibercept? And what I would say about aflibercept is my own personal experience with it has been the toxicity has been less than what I expected from reading the Valour trial. I didn't have any experience with it on the Valour trial because very few of those patients were treated in the U.S. It seems to be about as easy to give as Bev. And it's something that I consider. We have a first-line trial using it. And so a number of our patients are treated in first-line, and therefore not really candidates to use it in second line. The place that I would tend to look at using it off study in second line is in those patients that burn through first line therapy really quickly, and where I want to just reboot the computer and try completely different regimens, because I do believe that aflibercept is different fundamentally than bevacizumab.
I guess particularly with KRAS mutant or non-responsive subsets.
Correct. So, you know, the more drugs we have, the better. I don't know what the next new drug will be, but I'm sure looking forward to having it, whatever it is.
So I wanted to explore with you a little bit more about regorafenib that you mentioned. You also mentioned the trial starting to look at it in an earlier setting. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about this agent, any new information that's come out, and then we can chat a little bit about sort of clinically using the drug?
So, you know, it's a dirty kinase inhibitor, so it affects multiple important pathways in cancer cells, and that may actually be an appealing thing to do in the late line therapy where you have a diversity of mutations that we've accentuated by putting pressure on the tumor with our chemotherapy and targeted agents. The difficulty with using a drug that has a broad range is it also can have a broader range of toxicities because, of course, these biologic processes in our bodies weren't put there to be druggable. They were put there to be physiological. And regorafenib is a tough drug to give in an older population. Now, it's interesting. We have a second-line study where we're giving it with FOLFIRI, and I've actually found it much easier to give in an earlier line of therapy. Now, that may partly be that we're choosing patients that are both younger and healthier, as well as earlier on in their exposure to chemotherapy drugs. But it's been easier to give in full doses in the study than I've experienced in my off-study patients in last-line therapy.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out this whole thing about toxicity. I was curious, you know, in a way, it kind of reminded me when capecitabine came in, particularly in breast cancer, and, you know, people had such horrendous experiences with it, then they pulled back on the dose. And this, in a way, kind of reminded me a little bit of it. But I guess the one thing that's sort of unusual about this study that brought it into practice was that it was done in very late line disease. And I guess the indication is relatively late line disease. And you would expect that, I guess, the performance status and how much prior therapy and all these other things would be, you know, a huge factor in how people tolerate it. Is that kind of what you think is going on?
I do think that that's what's going on. And actually, we're talking about doing a 1 week on, 1 week off study to see if that allows us to get in more drug and to keep more patients on the drug for a longer period of time.
Have you used that strategy with capecitabine?
You know, I'm not a great fan of capecitabine, partly because of the unpredictable toxicity, partly because I want to be sure when I give a drug that the drug's in the patient's body and not in the medicine cabinet, and also because of the reimbursement issues. Now, I'm hoping that Congress will see fit to reimburse outpatient oral drugs the same way that they reimburse IV drugs. But until that happens, my preference to use infusional 5-FU, which has almost no toxicity most of the time.
What is, I'm hearing a lot of debate right now about what the starting dose of regorafenib should be, the question of whether you start low and escalate up. For practical purposes, what's sort of the range of dosing that you think about?
So I don't ever start people on 160 unless they happen to be somebody who's 40 or younger and really fit. So I'm generally starting people on 80 to 120. My older set, my group of patients with a lot of comorbidities, I'll start at half dose and escalate. My younger, fitter patients or older patients who have a better performance score, I'll start at 120. I'm almost never able to escalate, I find. And there are a fair number of patients that'll come to me, you know, at the end of their first month on study, holding their bottle of pills and say, I'm giving this back to you.
Well, one of the things I have heard is maybe the need to, you know, hook up with these patients, whether it's by phone or have them come in earlier. And, you know, that's sort of a theme that I've been hearing from the people who've had experience with the drug to try to find out what's going on, you know, within a week, for example. Is that sort of the way you approach it?
Yeah. You know, the nice thing about oral drugs is that you can intervene over the phone and say, take less tonight and from here on. So I think it's a great idea to put those patients in for a phone call a week after they start treatment and just check in with them and see how they're doing.
From a patient education point of view, you know, when you initially start someone on regorafenib, what are the things that you emphasize to them in terms of what to look for? And are there any sort of preemptive things that you do to prevent toxicity?
Well, I haven't found the answer to preemptive toxicity. You know, I'm a big believer in, when I put people on panitumumab and cetuximab, of using prophylactic measures to try and improve their rashes. But I haven't found a way to improve the hand-foot syndrome other than to tell people to use moisturizing creams, which I don't know makes a big difference. The fatigue is not really something you can manage. I don't think resting or not resting makes a difference. The muscle aches, you know, I don't want to start people on other drugs for muscle aches unless they have them. So I haven't found a real effective solution to modify the toxicity yet.
And one of the things that, you know, you hear a lot about, and in fact, I think there was actually even a poster on this, is the rapidity of onset of toxicity. What do you see? How long does it usually take before you start seeing problems if they're going to occur?
Well, often the problems occur very quickly. And in the CORRECT study, they did report that people who were able to tough it through the first cycle often did better on the second cycle. And so the toxicity seems to appear early and to peak early. And, you know, in some ways, this is like the skin toxicity many times with EGFR-targeted antibodies, where the most vigorous skin reaction tends to be in the first month or so, and then it gets a little better in many patients.
Incidentally, when you mentioned cetuximab and panitumumab, I was kind of reflecting back on your North Carolina days and the horror stories I used to hear from you about living in the reaction belt. Are you able to prescribe cetuximab nowadays, being in Ohio State, without, you know, having a, you know, an anxiety attack?
You know, I still have a little post-traumatic stress syndrome after having to intubate a couple of people on the floor of the chemotherapy suite with a lot of eyes on me. I do ask people if they've ever lived in North Carolina or Tennessee before I consider using it. We have a tendency to use panitumumab here for two reasons. One, it's less expensive. And second, we really haven't seen it cause any anaphylaxis in our patients.
Yeah, that thing about where they live is interesting because, you know, being in Florida, there are a lot of, you know, sort of snowbirds and people who move down here. And I know the docs are tuned in to asking them where they've come from in making that decision. Getting back to the issue of regorafenib, the final thing I was curious about is sort of where you see things heading in the future. You mentioned some trial strategies. I've heard people talk about research. I don't know if it's actually ongoing, looking at as a maintenance kind of therapy. Where do you see things heading?
Well, I would like to see if we could combine it with other cytotoxics. And, you know, we have a study doing that, and I know that there are other studies around the world looking at that. It's not that easy a maintenance. It's not like 5-FU, leucovorin, and Bev, which I do think really is an easier regimen for patients. So I think we just need to understand if we can dose it differently and still get benefit from it.
Maybe we can talk about another case. This 74-year-old man you say you saw last week with stage 2 disease seems interesting. I see he had 18 nodes sampled.
He had a T2 tumor, so an early stage tumor, and was relatively fit, so he was certainly a candidate for treatment if we chose to do it. And, you know, at the ASCO GI symposium, I did do a debate with Al Benson on to treat or not to treat. And of course, both of us reflected on how to use genotyping tools to help us make decisions there. And as you and the readership know, the difference between an oncotype high risk and an oncotype low risk is somewhere between 20 and 8% in that range. So a high risk patient would have a 1 in 5 chance of recurrence, a low-risk patient less than a 1 in 10 chance in recurrence. You know, I present the data of the modest benefit from 5-FU leucovorin chemotherapy. I don't give my low-risk stage 2 patients FOLFOX really ever. And we do MSI testing on all our patients. If they're MSI high, I talk them out of treatment if I possibly can. So for the T2 and the T3 N0 patients, I present them the data that you can get from an oncotype, and I say, you know, if a 20% risk of recurrence is going to lead you to take drug and an 8% risk of recurrence is going to lead you to not take drug, then it's worth ordering the test.
And I guess, I don't know if you believe in the concept that the relative risk reduction from, for example, fluoropyrimidine would kind of be the same over that, so that you could infer, you know, maybe a few extra points of absolute benefit in the higher risk patient. Do you sort of buy into that?
Well, in the higher risk patient, I think you do get a little bit bigger bang for your buck. If you look at stage three, again, as an example, the patients with the worst prognosis get the most benefit from adjuvant therapy. So those patients that have 15 positive nodes and a T3 tumor or even a T4 tumor have a terrible prognosis, but you can modify their prognosis the most with adjuvant therapy in that setting. So the higher the risk, the higher the benefit. I do agree with that principle.
So I'm just kind of curious. You say, of course, you see a lot of patients with stage two. How many do you end up doing Oncotype at all, or how often do you do it?
I do it rarely. So I would say that I've maybe done 4 or 5 in my entire practice, both here and in North Carolina, since the test came out.
And what about other assays like Coloprint?
So I haven't used those. We have a study looking at Coloprint in our stage two patients here. So if a patient's interested in that trial, then I would talk to them about that. You know, there are now 6 or 7 different companies that are looking at various genotyping platforms for stage two patients. Obviously, that much interest on the part of companies suggests that they feel that there's a market for this out there. I'd really like to be able to stratify my patients more accurately, both for stage two and stage three. You know, we may be over-treating some of the stage 3A patients who have a better prognosis than some of the stage 2C patients.
Let's spend the rest of our time talking about pancreatic cancer, and maybe we can start out with this patient you have, the 41-year-old.
So this was an interesting young woman, a 41-year-old woman who presented with abdominal pain, typical of what we see in pancreatic cancer, that boring pain in the back, and weight loss. And she's a woman who had struggled her whole life with being overweight and actually had a gastric banding procedure to reduce her weight. So this was a pretty atypical finding for her. She initially went to see her primary care doctor. She had an ultrasound of her gallbladder. They thought they saw sludge. You know, this is a story I see pretty commonly also, where somebody gets a laparoscopic cholecystectomy, and then suddenly we find out that that isn't what was making them sick. It was the mass in the head of the pancreas that wasn't seen on the ultrasound. And that's what happened in this woman. So she then had a CT scan. The CT scan showed a mass that was engulfing the superior mesenteric artery. Looked like it was invading into the back of the pancreas, into the area of the celiac axis. And she's only 41 years old, so we wanted to be as aggressive as we could be. We've had a pretty good experience at Ohio State and have a study that's ongoing of looking at FOLFOXIRI followed by gemcitabine with RT, followed by attempted resection. And so that was a direction that we took with this woman.
And what happened?
Well, when she started out on therapy, her CA19-9 was about 1,300. Within a couple of weeks of starting out on FOLFOXIRI, she had less pain, she felt better, and her CA19-9 rapidly went down to about 50. We reviewed her case in our multidisciplinary tumor board. Everybody felt that they should play a role in this, so the surgeons wanted to consider resection. The radiation oncologist wanted to consider radiating her if she continued to have a good response. So after about 8 weeks of FOLFOXIRI, we switched gears, gave her radiation, a relatively low dose of radiation, just about 3,400 centigrade. Her pain continued to get better. Her CA19-9 continued to go down, and 6 weeks after she completed radiation, she was taken to the operating room. She had mostly a necrotic tumor. The surgeon was able to do a head of pancreas resection with clean margins. She recovered well from surgery. We took out the gastric band while she was in the OR, since she now was lean and weighed like as much as she did when she was in high school. She's continued to have some pain. I think the character of the pain has changed. It's more incisional pain. As you might imagine, she has a pretty lengthy incision. We treated her with another 8 weeks of chemotherapy once she recovered from surgery, and now I saw her in November and saw her again a couple of weeks ago. We're weaning her off her narcotics. She's planning to go back to work. Her 19-9 is in the 20s, and so far, so good.
And I'm sure she's asking you, or her loved ones are asking you, maybe what to expect from the future. And I'm not sure how much data we have on that question in this specific situation. But generally speaking, do you have any sort of gut feeling about what the likelihood is of her developing progressive disease in the future?
So my gut feeling has me reaching for the Maalox, but when I talk to her, my usual comment to people like this is you're cured until we find out that you're not. And so live your life like you're cured. And if we find something, we'll deal with it then. But, you know, regardless, at the moment, everything is where we want it to be.
So can you talk a little bit about the dosing that you use with FOLFIRINOX and how you modify it, if at all? I meant to ask you before when you were talking about FOLFOXIRI, how you modify that. Maybe you can even compare the two regimens.
Well, so I tend to use them interchangeably. We use essentially full dose FOLFOX, and then we drop the irinotecan dose from 180 to 100. And we treat everybody with Neupogen because they do get neutropenic with it. And watch them like a hawk to be sure they tolerated it. Now, of course, very few of our patients are 41 years old, and this person, you know, went through the treatment without a lot of difficulty.
We have a bunch of docs in practice who review our programs and give us feedback. And one of the pieces of feedback we got recently from one of them was that we ought to spend more time talking about palliative management of pancreatic cancer. What are some of the palliative challenges that we face in management of advanced pancreatic cancer? And any, I'm not going to say mistakes, but any things that you see in people who get referred into you that maybe could be done better?
Well, what I would say is nutritional issues are always a problem in people with pancreatic cancer. Megase doesn't seem to be the answer to their prayers. Looking for other things to combat cachexia and anorexia, I think, is valuable. And there certainly are a number of different research endeavors looking at that. I think often people with pancreatic cancer malabsorb fats, and so I'm always asking them about that. And if I think that they may malabsorb fats, I don't do a 24-hour stool collection. I do a therapeutic trial of a pancreatic enzyme replacement and see how that works for them. I think that celiac axis blocks are probably somewhat underutilized. Now that you can do them under ultrasound guidance through an endoscope and not have to approach people with foot-long needles and do blind injections through the back, I think that we can get a higher likelihood of benefit from that. You know, just good pain management through the use of narcotics is another issue. And, you know, in the end, talking people through what we can expect to do for them in this setting, and palliative care is certainly a critical piece of that.
You mentioned malabsorption. What are the sort of clinical clues that you look for?
Well, so I ask people if they're family members go running for the exit when they head to the toilet, because, you know, often the stools in people that malabsorb fats are really stinky. I ask them for floating stools, oil in the toilet. You know, if they find that they avoid fatty foods because they cause them more GI cramping and upset and diarrhea, those are the things that I use as clinical indicators to try a pancreatic enzyme replacement.
How often do you see what you think is some kind of paraneoplastic syndrome? You know, patients with relatively small tumor bulk who are having a lot of systemic symptomatology.
You know, I don't think it's that common. I would guess that it's maybe 15% of patients with pancreatic cancer. But pancreatic cancer is the kind of cancer that gives cancer a bad name, no question about it, both because it extracts such a toll on people in terms of their ability to eat, their ability to maintain caloric balance, even to sit with their family at the table and enjoy a meal. And because often people will get diabetes associated with it, so that complicates what they can eat and how they can eat it. You know, it's just a tough disease.